Good morning and welcome to our podcast. My name is David Pritchard, Head of Marketing here at Sintance, joined again by my colleague Emma Saunders, who is partner and head of the contentious probate team here at Sintance. And our podcast today is another in our series of contentious probate related podcasts. And we're absolutely delighted to have guest speaker with us today, who is Samantha Lowe of Consentus Mediation. And we're delighted that Samantha is speaking to us and partaking in the podcast this morning. So thank you for coming along. The podcast today is going to concentrate on alternative dispute resolution. So without any further ado, I'm going to pass you straight over to Emma. Emma, good morning and over to you.
We hope that you've enjoyed our previous podcast about common claims that occur after someone has died, such as Inheritance Act claims, will disputes, proprietary estoppel claims, and disputes in estate administration. Today we are talking about how the parties in such disputes can use alternative dispute resolution, also known as ADR, in order to resolve those claims. In this podcast, we are going to cover: what is alternative dispute resolution, or ADR? Why should I consider it? What are the different types of ADR? And what is mediation? Please note that we are going to talk only about ADR in civil litigation and the forms most commonly used in trust and estate disputes. Mediation in a family context can be different. We also do not have the time today to discuss court-based ADR, such as early neutral evaluations and financial dispute resolution appointments, or FDRs.
Thanks, Emma. So, can you explain what is alternative dispute resolution?
ADR is a voluntary process whereby the parties seek to resolve their dispute without the involvement of the court. It can take a number of forms, such as negotiations over the telephone or in correspondence, roundtable meetings, or mediation. ADR can be entered into before a claim is issued at court. Alternatively, it can happen when there are court proceedings right up to the time of trial. Some cases even settle during the trial, though this is unusual.
And what do the courts think about ADR?
Yeah, good question, Sam. So what some people don't realise is that you shouldn't just rush off to court to demand a decision on a claim without seeking to reach a resolution with your opponent first. The courts encourage the parties to try to resolve matters outside of the courtroom. All litigants, whether claimants or defendants, should comply with a practice direction for pre-action conduct. This sets out the steps the court would expect the parties to take before a claim is issued at court. The practice direction, or pre-action protocol, says that litigation should be a last resort and that the party should consider whether negotiation or some other form of ADR might be used. You should also be aware that if you refuse to engage in ADR, the court can be made aware of this when a decision is being made about who should pay the costs of the claim. There is a risk that you'll be penalised in costs if the court considers your stance has been unreasonable, even if you go on to win your claim at trial.
Why else should other people consider ADR?
Yes, well, litigation can be costly, stressful, and lengthy. It can take a year or two, and sometimes longer, for a claim to reach trial. Attempting to reach a resolution outside court can mean that you spend much less on legal fees and bring the matter to an end much earlier. This can mean you can move on and put the dispute behind you. It is also important to bear in mind that litigation is inherently risky. However good you consider your claim to be, there is no guarantee of success. Reaching a settlement between the parties removes this risk and the associated stress. Negotiations always involve compromise, so you're unlikely to walk away with exactly what you want. That said, your opponent is likely to be feeling the same way. Most parties feel a great sense of relief if they conclude a negotiation successfully. It is important not to underestimate the impact that being involved in a dispute can have on your life. Another consideration in trust and estate disputes is that often the other parties to that dispute may be family members who you want to continue a positive relationship with going forward. This is more likely to be possible after ADR than if your claim concludes after a court judgment.
They're really good reasons. And what are the different types of ADR available?
Well, ADR can take a number of forms. In relation to estate disputes, mediation is often used, which I know, Sam, you're going to touch on in more detail shortly. Negotiations can take place, usually between solicitors, either over the telephone or in correspondence, or perhaps a combination of the two. Essentially, these are likely to be offers to settle the dispute on certain terms. This can lead to a chain of letters or phone calls as the parties move closer together in their demands. This can often be the most cost-effective way to resolve a claim, but does not always prove successful, especially in more factually complex claims. Sometimes a meeting is arranged between the party's solicitors, which the parties may also attend. This may be referred to as a round table meeting. This allows more detailed negotiations to take place, and the meeting could last an hour, or a day, or more. On occasion, it may be that a series of meetings are needed. If the parties are very hostile to each other, then this may not be an appropriate form of ADR, though it can be arranged so that the parties do not have to meet if needs be. More common in trust and estate disputes is mediation. So, Sam, you're a mediator. Can you tell us a little bit more about how mediation works?
I can, thank you. So, effectively, mediation is a standalone process, separate to the court process, albeit it can happen, like you say, either before the courts are involved or during the preparation of getting to the end result of court. And it's effectively when a neutral third party, such as myself, becomes involved to try and facilitate conversations and discussions between the parties with the aim of reaching a negotiated solution. How mediation works can vary. In most cases, a venue is agreed and the parties then have their own room in the venue, and the mediator can work between the two rooms trying to engage the parties in some form of discussion and facilitate a settlement. It can range from bringing parties together, just bringing lawyers together, or simply having the parties completely separate all day with the aim of trying to get to a solution that works for them.
Oh, excellent. So what would you see as the main benefits of mediation?
There are lots and lots of benefits to mediation, but the two main benefits that I think cover most of it is that confidentiality of the whole day is incredibly key, because it means that parties have their own private space and day to have conversations that they necessarily might not otherwise have had, and that they can be open and really consider different solutions to try and bring an end to the litigation without having a third party, such as a judge, impose an outcome on them that neither of them may want to see. And that brings me on to the next benefit, which is about the control and putting the power into the party's hands as to how an outcome might look. And it's usually an outcome that both sides can live with, and something that they can potentially work together to get an outcome that works for them, as opposed to having something imposed upon them. And the examples I would give are in an inheritance act claim, for example, the parties might be faced with a second marriage spouse bringing a claim and children to a first marriage, and they may want a complete clean break. And what the court might ultimately do is award a life interest, which binds the parties together for a long time. And a mediation allows the parties to actually consider what a solution might look like as a complete clean break, to allow them to move forward separate from each other.
That's great. Yes, yeah, certainly, Sam. As a solicitor who attends mediations with clients, I really do feel like the flexibility that the process gives is really important to clients going forward. Yeah. So how can clients help prepare their solicitor? Essentially, what should they do before the day of the mediation?
I think that clients need to be as upfront as they can with their solicitors, providing as much information as they can, especially in estate and trust disputes. One thing that a lot of time will be spent on at mediation potentially is the value of things. And so turning up with outdated information isn't usually that helpful. So if you can have upfront valuations of property, shares, assets, those type of things, how much cash is actually in the bank, that's really helpful. And also to be considering beforehand with the solicitor what outcomes they could actually live with ultimately if a deal was done, and what solutions might look like for them, so that we can start having those conversations as soon as possible on the day. And in terms of how the solicitor then prepares, the solicitor then will ensure that the mediator has the key documents that the mediator needs to read, and potentially prepare what we term as a position statement, which puts forward the client's position in advance. And then everyone can start the day with as much information as possible.
Great. Now, I think something that often comes up with my clients, they're often very nervous about meeting their opponent at mediation, because often there's been some correspondence and some things said that you know, makes people nervous about seeing that person. How would you deal with that as a mediator?
So Emma, that's actually very common, and people generally do feel that way, especially in contested probate cases where there's been some form of historical relationship in one form or another, and it's probably broken down either previous to the litigation or actually during the litigation. And the way that I approach mediations in that context is to treat every mediation differently and not force any particular process to happen. So if parties are saying to me that they don't want to see each other, then that's absolutely fine. I won't be forcing people to get around a table first thing and procrastinate and put forward their positions when it's absolutely unnecessary and it just increases the emotions of the day. And what I do say to people is never say never, because over the course of the day, if relationships can be salvaged, or people are saying to me, actually, I'm starting to feel a little bit different, then again, we just go with it on the day. And if people eventually want to see each other, then they can.
Lovely. That's really helpful. Something else that some of my clients worry about is that the other party might back out of any agreement reached after the mediation. What would your advice be to those people?
The aim of all mediations is to get to some form of binding settlement, and what we're all aiming to do is get some signatures on a piece of paper to give comfort to everybody there that people are bound by what they have signed up to do. And that's part of the reason why a mediation can last quite a long time and can go on for many, many hours. And the benefit of doing that is so that people leave eventually with the comfort of a signature on a piece of paper and some relief that the litigation itself is over, and that it will create a lot of difficulty for anybody to back out of it on the following day if they've signed up to it. What we can't do, and it's the same effectively even if the court makes an order, is force and guarantee that somebody will adhere to what they've agreed to do. But with mediation, people are attending to, in good faith, to come to a deal. And if they've come to that deal and signed up to it, it's as much comfort that you can get that people aren't going to back out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I must say, just myself, I've attended a lot of mediations with clients, and thankfully that hasn't been something that's happened to me yet, that someone's tried to back out. I do think generally I've found that parties, once they've reached that agreement, are generally content to go along with it, thankfully. Yeah. So, Sam, have you got any comments on what would happen if perhaps one of my clients or one of their opponents refuses to mediate?
Well, the main comment I would make is that mediation is voluntary, and it's important that it's voluntary, because what you don't want is people turning up to the mediation on the day after having spent a lot of money preparing for it and paying for the mediator, for someone to actually be using it as a ticky box exercise and not actually want to be there. But what I would say is that there are various consequences in place for somebody to outright refuse to mediate. And you can draw the court's attention to that refusal, as you mentioned earlier, Emma, on the question of costs. As a practical tip, if you are sort of hitting difficulty and somebody is refusing to mediate, one thing that can help is getting the mediator involved on the telephone quite early on to just talk about the benefits of mediation and why it might actually help, and to talk to the parties directly about that over the phone, just to explain a little bit like what we're doing now, and to effectively make sure that you've tried every which way to get them to the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that's useful to know that can be offered. Because I think one of the other concerns my clients have is if their opponent agrees to mediate, that they're only doing it because they feel they should and they're not really going to engage. So what would your advice be on that point?
A completely understandable concern, and it's something I do hear quite regularly, especially if there's a sort of historical acrimony between the parties. What I usually say is, if you've got them there and they're there on the day, then that, you know, they're there and we've got them there to have a conversation. And there's probably two roles that are important if there is any lack of engagement forthcoming, which would be, my role is there to keep everybody focused and to effectively explain to people, well, you're here, you've spent the money, let's try talking about what a solution might look like. You might as well use the day and not just sort of be bloody minded and stick your heels in. But equally, what I would say to the party who is more engaging than the other is to tactically use it to put forward something that will make them bite quite early on. And then you can actually then convince them that this is a worthwhile process and you are actually here to get a solution. And that can quickly change mindsets and quickly cause people to engage and use the process for what it is, which is an opportunity to get a settlement and to move forward with your life.
Yeah, no, definitely. So, Sam, obviously you've attended a lot of mediations. And so how successful do you find them generally in reaching a resolution at the end?
So mediations generally are very successful. And, you know, 95% of my mediations have settled. And it's very much a case of keeping going with parties and making sure that we've thought everything through. In terms of if they don't settle, there could be various reasons for that. But, you know, they tend to settle quite shortly thereafter because the mediation has focused minds and some people have just needed a little bit of breathing space to have a think. And as you've mentioned earlier on, things can settle very much last minute as when the reality of trial hits people. So generally, the mediation day is a very successful day, and I would encourage parties to really consider taking part in a mediation as early as possible to avoid increased legal costs and to literally try and look at a realistic solution to move forward.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, like I say, I think I've attended a lot of mediations myself and they are generally very successful. And I think that clients come out with that sense of relief that, you know, things are being put behind them and they can move forward with their lives.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that's all we've got time for today. So a big thank you to Sam Lowe from Consentus Mediation for joining us today. If you have any other questions on this topic, please do not hesitate to get in touch. Thank you for listening. And I'm going to pass you back to David.
Thank you both. Enjoyed listening to that podcast. Very quickly for me, as I say, at the end of each of these podcasts, we continue to work hard to produce, release, deliver useful and relevant content, articles, podcasts, blogs, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And that includes all episodes of our Contentious Probate related podcast series. There's a lot of seminars that we've done up there as well, and a lot of written content. So please do check it out. There really is a wealth of content, and it's all really, really useful stuff. So please do take a few minutes to have a look at that. If you haven't had enough of us by that point, you can also check the team out on Twitter at SintonsPC. Contact details for Emma, 0191-226-7878, or via email, emma.saunders@sintons.co.uk. For Samantha, you can check out all her details and what her business does, www.consentus-mediation.com. And again, it's a great website with a lot of content on, so please do check that one out as well. Obviously, either of our speakers will be happy to answer any questions that you have. Okay, so that's it from us today. There will be another Contentious Probate related podcast with you in about 4 weeks' time. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for sending in your questions and areas that you wanted to hear from us. We generally do appreciate it. We don't take it for granted. And we're so pleased that this podcast series is adding value to you. Stay safe, everyone, and thank you once again.